Georgia. My name is Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. I try not to scream into the microphone. I can't help it, though. I'm just so loud. Before I go any further, I want to say thank you. Thank you to the state of Georgia. Thank you to the Georgia Prepaid Convention Committee. Thank you for everybody who had anything to do with me getting here tonight. It is an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous for Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't my favorite way to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it happens sometimes, and here I am. And I don't know what your drinking career was like, but my drinking career was of the sort that people didn't invite me to their party. They asked me to leave, and so stay sober for a little bit. Maybe things will change, right? So it's good to be here with y'all, and it's really especially good to be able to spend some time with Diane. As she said, we met a few years ago down in Edisto Beach, South Carolina. We happened to be at the same conference and just have a lot of similarities in our stories and things that we've been through and events that have happened, and it was a pleasure talking to her then. And so when I was coming here, I was just super excited at the opportunity to get to spend some more time with her and hang out with her. And just because it's AA is like that, right? We just meet people, and you never know when your paths are going to cross again, and it's such a beautiful experience. So thank you for having me. My date of sobriety is December 10th, 1995. I didn't plan to stay sober this long, by the way. That was not the plan at all. So, fun fact, on December 10th, 1995, I was 23 years old. This year, in 2018, I turned 46. So this is the year I'm going to be sober half my life. And I'm really excited. I think I'm more excited about that than anybody else. Anytime I tell somebody that, they're like, yeah, and? And I'm like, but I'm so excited! Like, how cool is that? Nobody thinks it's cool but me. I'm going to stop talking about it, okay? But anyway, and I have a home group. My home group is the Atascocita group on the northeast side of Houston in Atascocita. We meet every day at noon and 6 p.m., except on Sundays. We meet at 10 a.m. instead of noon because we're alcoholics, and heaven forbid we make it too simple, right? I love my home group. It's been my home group for the last 4 or 5 years. We have some good book study meetings. We have a big book study on Monday nights. We have newcomers on Monday night, big book study on Tuesday night, 12 and 12 twice on Wednesday, Ask Bill Season on Thursday. So we've got a lot of good topic meetings that keep us in the book and keep us in the solution, and I love that. But what I really love about my group is it's like one of those old buildings where the couches are all your grandma's couch, right? With the flowers and the holes. And I'm a little nervous to sit on them personally, but I used to sit on the chairs. But I love those type of AA groups. When they're too clean and the chairs are too new, they make me a little nervous. I like the ones where there's paint on the chairs and holes in the couches and stuff. So I feel right at home at Atascocita group. It was a smoking group when I first started going there, and now nothing is smoking anymore. So we got to paint the walls because they weren't turned yellow again. So we painted the walls, so it's nice and clean looking. I have a sponsor. I have a new sponsor. I've had her for about the last 2 years. She's my fifth sponsor. I was just telling Diane today that I always love those stories of people who say, I came in and I got sober and I've had the same sponsor for the last 20 years. And that wasn't my story. I've had five sponsors, six if you count me, because, yeah, I did a little stint with that, okay? Yeah, that girl was the worst sponsor ever, by the way. Anyway, thank gosh it didn't last very long, and I stayed sober through that. But so I'm on my fifth sponsor. I really like this one. She's been my sponsor for the last couple years, and it's been a good relationship. It's always good to have the opportunity to form a new relationship with a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also am a sponsor. I got a couple girls I'm sponsoring right now. Not my favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the big book tells me that nothing will so much ensure my sobriety as intensive work with other alcoholics. And so when a woman reaches out and I have the time and the availability, my answer is yes. And but it's always an interesting experience. And I'm going to tell you about this young girl that I'm sponsoring now. And she came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was youngish. She was in her late 20s. And we started, she asked me to sponsor her, and I said yes. So we started reading, and we started working steps. And after she had actually from the beginning, she kept saying, you know, Tammy, I just don't know if I belong here. And I said, well, I don't know either. You know, that's not my decision to make. That's your decision to make. Well, you know, talk about it, and then you decide. She was like, okay. And she was like, later on, she's like, well, Tammy, I just don't know if I belong here. What do you think? And I'm like, I think it's not my decision to make. It's your decision to make. I don't know if you belong here either. She was like, but what do you think? And I was like, well, I think it doesn't matter what I think. This is you have to do this. I don't know. And So then we keep going on, and we work some more steps and talk some more. And she's like, Tammy, I just don't know if I belong here. And I'm like, I don't know either. And she's like, I need you to tell me. I said, okay, fine. Fine. Okay. So based on what you've shared with me through our working the steps and some of the stories and some of the experiences, I think it's more likely than not that you may have a problem with alcohol. And she said, okay. She seemed fine with that. And then a little bit later, she's like, okay, Tammy, so you say more likely than not. Is that like a 51% chance or a 99% chance? And I'm like, you're going to drive me crazy. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. You ready? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to keep working steps, and you are not going to ask me this question again. Not going to ask me this question again until you get your 6-month chip. We're going to work steps. We're going to meet. We're going to do this. And you're going to get your 6-month chip. And once you get your 6-month chip, if you feel the need to revisit this topic with me, we will revisit the topic. And so we work some steps, and we meet, and we work steps, and we meet. And she goes to get her 6-month chip, and she doesn't ask me about it too much anymore. I will tell you, that girl last Saturday got her 4-year sobriety anniversary. So I'll tell you, my money would have not been on her, right? It's a good thing they don't let us bet on newcomers. Like, I would be poor, right? I'll get it wrong every time, because I would have never thought she would stay. And she got her 4-year sobriety chip last Saturday, and I would have never seen that one coming, but that was it. So, and I believe in the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our triangle talks about recovery, unity, and service, and I believe all three are equally important. The steps obviously ensure my recovery if I practice them as a daily way of life. The traditions ensure the unity of all of us and keep us right with the world, and then there's the service piece of it. And if I could live on the side of the triangle, I would live on the service side of the triangle. That's where I would live. I would live in service. I love Alcoholics Anonymous service. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous service early in recovery. It took me changing home groups a few times, running into all the right people, doing all the right things, and just running into the right people who opened doors for me and showed me that there is a big world of AA out there outside of my home group. My first love and my most passionate love is corrections work. I am a committed volunteer to a women's prison on the northeast side of Houston. I take a meeting on the first and fifth Wednesday of every month to Plain State Jail. And we have a meeting with those women at that facility. I also participate on the corrections committee. Right now I'm the correspondence chair, so I'm responsible for hooking up those on the inside with those on the outside in correspondence format through letters. Love doing that. It's a great service opportunity. I'm also involved in my group right now. I'm the CFC rep. I've done a few things. I try to stay involved in my group in some capacity. I'm rolling off my 2-year term as DCM of my district. I'm the DCM for District 31, Area 67, Southwest Region, Great State of Texas, Southwest Region. I'm finishing up my 2-year term as DCM, and I didn't even want that position 2 years ago, and now I don't want to give it up, but that's how it works, right? We just had our area elections, and I am the incoming 2019-2020 registrar for the Southeast Texas area, so that'll be my new 2-year service commitment at the area level, and I'm really excited. I'm excited about all of that. Corrections, general service, all of it, I love it. I think it's great, and I'm so thankful that I ran into all the right people who opened all the right doors for me to introduce me to AA outside of just my home group and how big and beautiful it is. So thanks for having me here. Let me read you something. And there is a solution towards the end. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And that's interesting to me that it says in our personal stories that that's what we do. So I hope I can convey that to you tonight, because that's to me what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about me finding a relationship with a higher power that's personal to me, you know, that I can build this way of life with. And so I really like that. Let me go back a few years for you. October, when I was thinking about it, October has been a monumental month for things happening in my life. So October 1995, 23 years ago, I had just pled guilty to 4 felony charges. October 1996, 22 years ago, I had just been released from prison. I know y'all saw me walk up the podium, right? And y'all thought, that girl looks like a convicted felon, doesn't she? Yeah. I know y'all are thinking that. You don't have to tell me. It's okay. Just kidding. So how does that happen, right? So backtrack a little bit more. June 6th, 1995. I was 23 years old. I was driving a brand new car. I had started out my evening drinking, as I am wont to do after just enough drinks. I decided to get in my car and go somewhere. I don't know where I was going to this day. I was going somewhere though. Somewhere other than where I was. Somewhere along that journey, I wrecked my car. And just bashed in the driver's side of my brand new car, and I was very upset. I then proceeded to go home. I called home, called my parents. I was really upset. I said, "Can I come home?" And they said, "Sure, come on home." So I got in my little wrecked car, and I proceeded to drive home, and I wrecked my car a second time that night, not without so much consequence. I was driving to excess. My blood alcohol level, later to find out, was at minimum a 0.23. I was driving in a blackout most of the time. As a result of my drunk driving, I hit another vehicle. In that vehicle were two mothers and two daughters. One of the mothers died at the scene of the accident, and the other mother and the two little girls in the car were all life-flighted to the hospital. June 6, 1995. 23-year-old girl driving a brand new car. What I want you to know is when I got in my car that night, I promise you, I did not mean for that to happen. Promise. There was no thought in my mind whatsoever when I got in my car that anything might happen. You know? Maybe you can understand this, maybe not, but there was no thought in my mind about anything but me and where I needed to go and how fast I needed to drive to escape and to get away. That was it. Just trying to go somewhere, just trying to be somewhere else, just trying to run, just trying to see if I can escape it, right? Never occurred to me that anything could happen. Never occurred to me. But it did. I don't know if you remember my sobriety date. My sobriety date is not June 6, 1995. My sobriety date is December 10th, 1995. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was desperately trying to convince you I did not belong here. I was too young. I didn't drink long enough. I was really smart. If you only knew all these things, you would understand that I do not belong here. In hindsight, I think a normal person, June 6, 1995, would have been enough. It would have been a sufficient reason. Not me. I was drunk the next week. It was my next best excuse to have a drink. Do you know what happened to me? Of course it was about me. Do you know what happened to me? Right. Yeah, let's have a beer. How about another? How about a bunch? That wasn't my last drink either. I drank a few times over the course of the next several months until my sobriety date. I got sentenced on October 13th, 1995, 23 years ago. I got sentenced to 10 years probation. In addition to that 10 years probation, I had all these conditions, one of which was to go to this place called a safe pee, which they told me was treatment. It's not. So they told me it was treatment, and then I had to go to an outpatient, and then I had to go to halfway house, I had to go to outpatient, I had to go to AA meetings three times a week, I had to do 180 days in jail, I had to do 500 hours of community service, I had to pay back $16,000, I had to have a breathalyzer installed in my car, and, right? All these things. That was October 13th, 1995. Let me remind you of my sobriety date. It is December 10th, 1995. So even agreeing to all the conditions of probation, it still wasn't enough. That was not enough for me to stop drinking. The last time I drank alcohol was December 9th, 1995. I was working at this little restaurant. They had transferred me from one to the other because of all this stuff. And I was working at this restaurant, and these people didn't know me very well. And they were having a party, and they invited me. I'm sure they wish they hadn't, by the way. So I was just that kind of girl. And I went to the party knowing I was going to drink, and I arranged a ride. And so when my ride got there, I had brought a six-pack, which is cute, right? That's cute. Like, that's enough. Yeah. Six-pack, like, it's called delusion, right? It's called denial and delusion. A six-pack is going to do it, right? Anyway, so I drank my six-pack, and then when my six-pack was gone, I drank your beer and everybody else's beer in the refrigerator. I'm sure they didn't notice, right? Yeah, I'm sure they didn't notice. Anyway, by the end of the night, I was extremely intoxicated. I had a ride home, I did all the things that I do when I put alcohol into my body. So that was my last drink, December 10th. I didn't know December 10th was going to be my sobriety date, by the way. It just happened like that. Shortly thereafter, all the conditions of my probation kicked in. The first thing that I had to do was in January 1996, I had to turn myself into county jail, waiting to go to the safety, which they told me was treatment. So I'm waiting to go to the safety, and I'm in county jail. And someone had given me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took it with me, okay? Not because I needed it, you understand, right? Just because they did, and I wanted to be polite, so I took the book with me. So I go into county jail, and I've got this book, and I start to read this book in county jail. Mind you, I'm not even a month without drinking yet. And I start to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the best I can probably come up with at this point is I had read everything else I possibly could, and I ran out of reading material, so I said, I guess I'll read this one. I don't know. So I somehow open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I somehow get to the steps at some point. I don't know if I read all the way through or skimmed. I have no idea. But I know that at some point I got to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in January of 1996, having not drank for, you know, less than a month, and not even thinking I have a problem with alcohol, just being bored, I start reading the steps. And my first read sounded something like this to me in a jail cell. Okay? Step one, powerless, unmanageable. I look around and I say, I think I'm doing fine. Yeah. No problems here. Yeah. Steps two and three, start talking about God. We just skip those immediately. Immediately jump those because Steps four and five, start talking about personal inventory and looking at ourselves. Like, this is such a foreign concept to me. I can't even wrap my head around it. So we should probably go ahead and skip those as well, right? Yeah. Get to step six and seven, start talking about character defects and shortcomings. And I again pause for a moment and think, and I can't come up with a single one, so I guess I don't need to work those either, right? And then I read steps eight and nine, and something about steps eight and nine grabbed me and just pulled me in, that we make amends for harms we've done. Now, I've told you about some pretty horrendous harm that I have done already, but that's not what I thought about when I read those steps. What I thought about was, you know, my parents had really supported me during all of this time of being in trouble. And I thought, you know, I've really drug them through some circumstances, and I should probably write them some letters and tell them how sorry I am for everything that I've done. So me, being less than 30 days without alcohol, sitting in jail, deciding that steps 1 through 7 do not apply to my life, I decided to write amends letters to my parents. That's what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody want to guess about my program early days? Yeah. Anybody? Yeah. It's not a hard bet to take there, I bet. So that's what I did. But I'm in jail for 2 weeks and go through the steps, and then they come to take me to the SAFP. And SAFP stands for Substance Abuse Felony Punishment Facility. I don't know if you guys have these here or not, but we have them in the state of Texas. And what this is it's prison. Yep, that's what it is. It's not treatment. They lied. Whoever they are, they lied. Not treatment. This is prison. We go in. We give up our street clothes. I've got TDC whites, TDC boots, TDC everything. I get my bunk assignment. We walk outside the yellow line. I eat when they tell me to eat. I get up when they tell me to get up. I shower when it's time they tell me to shower. I can do whatever. I'm under some pretty strict guidelines here. So the rules were either you had a job or you got an education. And since I already had an education, I had already graduated from high school. I didn't qualify for that, so I had a job. And my first job in prison was on the hoe squad. Fun. So I don't know if y'all know, but when you dig, there's some muscles back here, like, that I didn't even know I had, okay, right? And the next day, I'm like, ugh. Anyway, so then I eventually get off the shovel squad, whatever the heck they call it, and get moved on. And, you know, I don't have a lot of fond memories of that. Maybe surprising, but I don't have a lot of fond memories of that time there. And I have to tell you, in hindsight, I think that's what it's designed to do, right? I think it's designed so that you don't want to come back. And, I don't want to go back. But that's where I was. I was there. It was a 9-month program I was in. The safety program was a 9-month program, and I somehow managed, because I'm brilliant, to stay 9.5 months. Just couldn't get enough, I guess. I don't know. So I was there 9.5 months. So I was locked up all in for 10 months. I was released in October of 1996. I went down to the halfway house, was there for a couple months, and then they released me to go back home and live with my parents. And then I started just working out the conditions of my probation. Now, I had a sponsor at that time. She was a friend of my stepmother's, and she had started writing to me while I was in prison. So she was writing to me while I was there, and while I was there, there is no doubt I was not at the fully conceived to my innermost self point that I was an alcoholic. I still had a lot of doubts and a lot of questions and a lot of just things that I just couldn't reconcile and couldn't get there. But between being there and the level of humility that just brings in and of itself, as well as writing to this woman and her sharing some stories with me, I got to a place where I was able to say maybe. You know, maybe there's something to this. Now, that environment was not conducive for somebody like me because a lot of people were very forceful and they wanted to tell me what I was and what I needed to do and all that. Then I kind of balk at that. Like, when you come at me like that, I'm kind of like, "Woo, no, we're going the other way." But I was able to get to that maybe place. So I'm released, and I'm thinking maybe, and part of my conditions of my probation are to go to three AA meetings a week and get this little paper signed. And I'm doing that, right? So I've got this sponsor who's been writing to me, and I'm going to my three AA meetings, and I'm working out all the conditions of my probation. I'm reporting, I'm paying my money, I'm doing my community service. I had to do 180 days in jail on the weekend. So as soon as I was released from prison and went back home, I had to do 180 days in jail on the weekend. So another fun fact, because I know you're all dying to know, it takes exactly 1 year and 2 months of going to jail every single weekend in order to work off 180 days in jail. So every weekend from January of 1997 until February of 2008, no, those aren't the right dates, 97 to 98, whatever, you get what I mean, right? 14 months, 1 year and 2 months. Every Friday night I turned myself into county jail, and every Sunday afternoon they let me out. 1 year and 2 months later, I finished my 180 days in jail. So I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. And this sponsor that's a friend of my stepmother, she's a wonderful woman. Wonderful woman was a perfect first sponsor for me. So here's the deal, right? Like, she didn't make me do anything, and I didn't want to do anything, and so we got along great, right? I did my first 4-step when I was 4.5 years sober. Don't recommend that to anybody, by the way. Anybody want to put bets on how my sobriety was early days? Yeah. So that's just what it was, right? I was plugging along. I was doing what I was supposed to do. I'm working off the conditions of my probation. I'm paying my fees. I'm doing everything. I got a job. You know, I'm released to go back home, and I got a job. I'm working at my job, I'm doing my sentencing and all this stuff, and oh yeah, that's right, I met a man, right? Yeah. And meeting a man is the answer to all my problems today. Yeah, not really, that's not in the book if you're new. That is not in the book. Not in the book if you're new, right? So I probably believed that back then, right? I met this guy, and me and him he's my soulmate, and we're good, and I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, right? I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. I'm working. I go back to school. I've got this boyfriend. My family is close. My mom lives down the street this way. My dad lives down the street this way. My sister's right over here. Me and this guy are here, and I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, right? I'm going to AA meetings. I'm going to AA meetings, right? So the condition of my probation said that I was supposed to go to 3 AA meetings a week and get my paper signed. Any guesses how many I went to each week? That's right. Not 4. That's ridiculous. Like, that's just silly. Why would you do more than you needed to, right? So 3. I showed up when the meeting started. When the meeting was over, I grabbed my paper, said, "See ya," and I left, right? I wasn't disruptive, but I was just taking up space. But my life was just kicking along, right? My life was kicking along. There was a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear of going back to prison. And so a lot of fear. So I was doing everything I needed to do. I was keeping my nose clean, and all that. And I had all these normal people that I just told you about as my support group. Okay. And all that is fine until it's not fine, right? Until God one day decides to give me what I didn't know was a beautiful gift that was wrapped in a really, really, really ugly package, right? So when I was 5 years sober, in the year 2000, when I was 5 years sober, and I'm kicking along and everything's just fine, and I'm not participating in AA, but I'm sober and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and at 5 years sober, my whole world that I had built up fell apart. The boyfriend started doing some things that were not conducive to our relationship. I found out my mom was doing something that really hurt my feelings. My dad did something that really hurt my feelings. And all these people that I had surrounded myself with and made my support group all failed me in the same year. Now, for a really long time, I thought, isn't that just a coincidence? I like that word today, right? Isn't that just interesting? What are the chances that would happen? But it happened. All in the same year, all these people that I had put my support, my life, you know, support into, all failed me in the same year. So it was devastating to me. It was just devastating. But what I realized from that is that that was what you people had been telling me for the last 5 years that this was all about, right? You'd been telling me for the last 5 years that this is the design for living, that this is life on life's terms, and this is how we deal with life. And I was listening, but I wasn't ready to put it into action because I didn't need to. Everything was fine with me, right? Everything was fine. And then I finally understood. I finally understood what you guys have been telling me for 5 years. And I was finally in enough pain that I was willing to reach out my hand to another woman and say, will you help me? And so then I got sponsor number two. I got sponsor number two, who actually went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and who actually made me do something. And so we started reading the book and we started working the steps. And this time when we read the book and this time when we work the steps, it looks a little bit different than it did when I read them in county jail, right? Because step one says powerless and unmanageable. You think? Yeah, I don't know. Most 23-year-olds might not be a four-time convicted felon. Who knows? You know, the whole thing, I was 23 years old. That brand new car was 6 weeks old and I totaled it. That accident made me have to leave my job, leave my apartment, quit school, go live back with my parents, four-time convicted felon. Very unmanageable, right? And my drinking was completely, I did not know my drinking was out of control until I came here and you told me what an alcoholic was, right? I thought it was normal. I surrounded myself with people who drank like me, so I never knew my drinking was abnormal until I came here and you guys told me about your drinking. So it's maybe not normal for a 23-year-old to be drinking on a daily basis. I don't know. I didn't know, right? So I thought I didn't drink long enough. I didn't start drinking until I was probably about 19. So from 19 to 23, the progression went from drinking a little bit, drinking on the weekends, drinking maybe on Wednesdays as well as the weekends because there was a long time between the weekends, right? And then, you know, from there, maybe add in Thursday, Friday, Monday, whatever, right? By the time I'm 23 years old, I was drinking on a daily basis. I had arranged my life so that I could drink. I was a waitress and I only worked the night shift. And the reason I only worked the night shift is because I couldn't get up in the morning. I could not get up in the morning. I would get up sometime in the afternoon. I would get something to eat, settle my stomach, go to work, do it over again, stay up till whenever at night, drink till it was blackout, pass out, whatever. We went to whoever's house, had beer. That was the way it worked. And that's what I did at the age of 23. I drank on days when I said I wasn't going to. I drank on days when I thought I didn't want to. The opportunity presented itself and I was there. That was my life. That was my life, but I didn't know. I didn't know that's not what everybody did. I thought that's just what we did. So you guys told me that. You guys told me that you told me about your drinking, which made me see my own problem with alcohol. So that one after the 5 years working with the new sponsor was like, okay, I got it. Fully conceded my innermost self. I got it, right? And then steps two and three start talking about God. And I will tell you, this is like the linchpin. This is what makes Alcoholics Anonymous for me what it is, right? Because, you know, Evie comes into Bill's kitchen. I might have that wrong. I hope I didn't mess up my history. I'm sure somebody will tell me I did. But there's a line in Bill's story. It says, why don't you choose your own conception of God, right? Why don't you choose your own conception of God? So when I was little, we grew up, you know, in the church or whatever, and I hated church. And then I became an adult, and I just thought the whole idea was a bunch of malarkey and yada, yada, and blah, blah, blah. And I come in here, and you guys start talking about God, and I'm like, oh, we cannot go there. We just cannot go there. But Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make me believe what that everybody believed when I was a kid. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make me believe what you believe. Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I can believe in a higher power, whatever works for me, as long as it's not me, right? As long as it's not me, I can choose my own conception of a higher power. How amazing is that? How amazing is that? That I don't have to believe any preconceived idea or any preconceived notion that I had. I can throw that all out and choose my own conception of a higher power. How amazing is that? It's amazing. Steps 4 and 5 start doing personal inventory, and it tells me in step 5 that if I skip this vital step, I may not overcome drinking. That's a pretty powerful reason to me, right? I did my first, 4th, and 5th step with the first sponsor when I was 4 or 5 years sober. I did them again, this time with this sponsor in a real fashion, and put all my harms down on there, all my resentments, fear, sex, the whole deal, right? Step 6 and 7 start talking about character defects. Plenty of those. And I love 6 and 7, right? So we've got 1 through 5 on this side. We've got 8 through 10 on this side. So 5 on this side, 5 on this side. And these are the 2 in the middle, right? These are the 2 in the middle. So what I love about them is the first 5 show me who I am and all of these things. The 2 in the middle say, okay, Tammy, now you've seen all these things. What are you going to do about it? And then steps 8 through 12 give me that opportunity to do something different. You know, just right in the middle. I love it. Steps 8 and 9, making amends. I had some pretty serious amends that I needed to make that were on my list. I was not ready to do it. The thought of making amends to any of the people in that car accident made me almost physically sick for many, many years, even thinking about having to make any attempt to write that, and I just couldn't do it. So made all the amends that I could and moved on to 10, 11, and 12. And step 10 tells me to continue to do all those things. Step 11, I continue to increase my awareness of God. And step 12, practice principles and carry the message, right? So what I learned about working the steps with that sponsor that time is when I choose to do something different, like work the steps, like participate in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of take up space in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I choose to do the things that you'd been telling me to do the whole time, and I do something different, my life becomes different. My life just becomes different. And it did. It did. I worked the steps and I started to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. First at my group level, and then when I moved, you know, from place to place, started to just open and expand my horizons and learn about Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And it has become a huge part of my life. And when I choose to do something different, it just happens. It just becomes different. And things did. Things did. That boy that was my soulmate, you know, things just didn't work out. And in 2001, we split up after, no, that wouldn't be right. It doesn't matter. It was 2004. It doesn't matter. So, I act like the date matters, you know, like y'all are going to remember or something, right? So, so in 2004 it was, we had been together 6 years and we split up, and it was devastating. It was devastating because I really did think he was the love of my life and we were going to be together forever, and that didn't happen. And, but you know, the difference between 5 years and the gift and ugly wrapping paper, and then when we split up was huge because I had really started to practice Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and it was devastating, but I didn't throw a tantrum like a 2-year-old. I said, you know what? This is life on life's terms. This is my design for living. This is just things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not every day is puppy dogs and rainbows, right? I mean, sometimes I get really pissed off in traffic, whatever. And, you know, it's just like that. This is life on life's terms. And I made it through that with your help. You know, I made it through that with your help as well as everything else that's happened. And as a result of being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and being involved in my life, you know, things happen. And so I started things when I was drinking. And one of the things I started when I was drinking was I started to get a college education, and that didn't work. Sort of committed some felonies and derailed that plan. But I ended up finishing college in sobriety. In 2003, I got my 4-year degree, and 2 years after that, I got some letters behind my name given to me from the state of Texas. And so I started to finish things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had only started when I was drunk. When I was 6.5 years sober, I went to a meeting at my then home group, and the meeting topic was on steps 8 and 9. And when they were talking on steps 8 and 9, when it was my turn to share, I shared that there were some amends that I hadn't made. And the reason I hadn't made them is because the book tells me in the amends part that if there's a valid reason for postponement, you know, I can postpone. And we were just talking about how we alcoholics can find the loophole, right? So it says that in the big book. I mean, it really does. I didn't make that up, but I used it as an excuse for way longer and way not what it meant, right? And so I said, there's a valid reason for postponement, blah, blah, blah. And someone after me shared and they said, yeah, Tammy, that may be great, but what if you miss your chance? You know, what if you miss your opportunity? And when I left the meeting that day at 6.5 years sober, I finally realized that I was ready. I was ready to make these amends. And the reality was, is I was just in a lot of fear about it. But fear won't kill me. You know, and I also don't have to walk through it alone. You all are there with me if I choose to let you in and let God in. I'm not alone. So I went home and I dug up a whole bunch of police reports and I dug up all that information and made a date with the phone to make some amends. And I did. So I picked up the phone. I don't like the phone on a good day. The phone is very, very heavy on a good day for me. But on a day like this, it's especially heavy. And the first phone number that I called was the husband of the woman who died in the car accident. So this is 7 years later, okay? 7 years later, I'm looking at a police report with a phone number on it, and I'm fairly certain that nobody's phone number is the same. But God had a different plan, right? So I called the phone number of the husband of the woman who died in the car accident, and a man answered the phone. I asked for him, and he said it was him. And I said, my name is Tammy Skyby, and I don't know if you know who I am. And he said, I know who you are. And why wouldn't he know who I was? It's ridiculous for me to think he wouldn't know who I was. And I still to this day wish that I had a beautiful, eloquent story of an amends that I made. But the reality is I started to cry. And then I started to sob almost to a level that I couldn't talk. I did manage to tell that man how sorry I was for my actions and how they had harmed his family. I told him that I hadn't drank in 6.5 years and that my life was different. And he proceeded to tell me that that he missed his wife. He said his little girl missed her mom. He said his little girl's injuries were very bad and it took a long time for them to heal. But she was better. He said he didn't understand why it happened. He didn't understand why his wife was taken. He said, but I forgive you. And I will tell you that I could have probably understood a whole lot of anything better than that right at that moment. So what I understand is that he should resent me, that he should hate me, that he should be angry at me for my actions and how they've impacted his life. But what that man said is, I forgive you. And why would he? Why should he? How could he? Right? So after that, I called the other family and I couldn't get in touch with them. And then I called a truck driver who was in the accident. I hit them. The truck driver hit me, not because he meant to. I called him and I said, I'm sorry for my actions and how they had impacted your life. I mean, the guy almost lost his job and a whole bunch of other things. And I said, I'm really sorry for everything that happened. And he said, oh, I forgive you. Like, why? It's baffling. So after those phone calls, I started to send a Christmas card to the family of the woman who died and to the truck driver every year. And the truck driver would send me a Christmas card back, and he'd say, Merry Christmas, and he'd send me a little scratch-off lottery ticket or something like that. And, you know, he and I became, like, I wouldn't say friends, but he started to be like a little, he would look out for me. He'd call me every now and then. He'd just be like, Tammy, I was thinking about you. Are you doing okay? And I was like, I'm doing fine, Danny. And I don't know. It was just, I don't know. And then one time I asked that man, I said, will you do me a favor? And he said, yeah. And I said, will you meet with me and tell me what happened in that car accident? I said, because I don't remember anything. I have a police report, but I really don't know what happened. And I know you saw everything. And I was wondering if you would tell me what happened. And he said, are you sure you want to hear that? And I said, I think I need to hear that. And that man agreed to meet me. He met me for dinner. I met him. He told me everything that he saw. He said it was the worst car accident he'd seen in all of his years of driving a truck. And he told me everything I wanted to know and answered every question that I asked him. And it was hard to hear. It was very, very hard to hear. But I'd be forever grateful to him for sharing that with me so that I could know the full repercussions of my actions. I needed to know that. I also started to send a Christmas card to the other family, and when I was 9 years sober, I got a Christmas card back in the mail from that little girl. That little girl was 7 years old when that car accident happened, and so if I was 9 years sober, she would have been about 16, and she sent me a Christmas card, and she said, Merry Christmas to you and your family. And I thought maybe it was a fluke, but I sent a Christmas card the next year, and she sent me a Christmas card back the next year when I was 10 years sober. And then she sent me one when I was 11 years sober, and when I was 12 years sober, and when I was 13 years sober. I have not gotten a Christmas card every single year since I was 9 years sober. I've gotten a Christmas card most years since I was 9 years sober from that little girl. And over the course of the last 12 years or whatever, that little girl has shared her life with me. She has shared parts of her life with me. She told me that her father is her hero. That little girl graduated from high school, and she told me she graduated from high school. And then that little girl went to college, and she told me she graduated from college. That little girl met a nice young man, and she was going to get married, and she told me she was going to get married to this nice young man. She told me that she learned forgiveness from her mother. She said her mother was a very forgiving person and always told them to be forgiving, and that she learned that from her mother. She sent me a little card, and she said when she was little, her mom used to take her to the mall, and she would buy these little inspirational cards and give to her to carry around with her. And she said, I bought some cards, and I want to share one with you. And she sent me a little inspirational card, just like her mom used to do for her. And she shares that with me, you know? I don't deserve to be a part of that little girl's life, you know? My actions caused her family more harm than anything. And that little girl is sharing little inspirational cards with me. It's incredible. So what I understand today about forgiveness, the big book tells me, right? These people don't know the big book, right? But the big book tells me that if I hold on to hatred and anger and resentment, I can't walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. And somehow those people have a God or a something of their understanding that they know they can't hold on to those things and walk in the sunlight of the Spirit. And so those people forgave me for them. And that's what I understand about forgiveness today, is their forgiveness of me had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with them needing to let that go and forgive so that they could live free, you know, in their own sunlight of the Spirit. And what I've also learned about forgiveness is their forgiveness of me or my forgiveness has nothing to do with saying that what you did was okay. You know, they're not saying that what I did was okay or what I did was right. That's not what they're saying at all. And when I forgive someone else for the harms, I'm not saying it's okay or that it's right. I'm just saying that I need to do that because I can't live with that resentment and anger and be free. That's what I learned from them. It's an incredible thing. But anyway, in 2005, I got off probation. My probation was from October 13th, 1995 until October 12th of 2005. I successfully completed all the conditions of my probation, and I was released from probation. And I will tell you that by the time October 12th, 2005 came around, I didn't even care anymore, right? It was just another day. It was just another day that I went to work, that I stayed sober, that I went to a meeting, that I did whatever it is that I was supposed to do. I don't know. And life is just life. And every day hasn't been puppy dolls and rainbows. Like I said, I've done some things in sobriety that I'm not proud of. When I was 10 plus years sober, I damaged my relationship with my sister, and I wish I could give you a good reason for it, but I don't have one, right? I just don't have one. And, I have spent the last, 10 plus years trying to repair the damage that I've done to that relationship with my sister, because I love my sister and she's a good woman and a good person, and she loves me. And And so not everything, you know, I haven't done everything perfectly. I haven't done everything right. Made a lot of mistakes along the way. But I would like to tell you a little bit about how God works in my life over the last few years. So in late 2017, which was about this time last year, actually, I went to a doctor and they told me that I had a little health problem. And this was weird for me because, you know, I must have been 45. I was 45 at the time, and 45 years of perfect health. Like, the only thing that ever happens to me is I get a cold every other year or something like that, right? Perfect health for 45 years. So I go to the doctor, and they tell me I have this little health problem, and I start getting into some fear, and I'm like, ooh, wow, that's scary. Health problem, you know, doctor's tests, all this kind of stuff, and yada, yada, rigmarole. I know it's not abnormal, but it was abnormal for me, for sure. So let me rewind just a little bit. In 2015, October 2015, as a matter of fact, I went on vacation with my father, my stepmother, and my sister, and ended up not having a very good time at all. So and during that vacation, it was just too close quarters with family. Too close quarters with family, a little bit too much time, a little bit too much oneness, you know, not enough space, that kind of thing. Ended up during that time developing a bit of a resentment against my stepmother. And just having some difficulties on that vacation. And over the course between October of 2015 and October of 2017, just kind of nursed that for 2 years. You know, just kind of nursed it and just kind of held on to it. I wasn't really ready to let it go, and kind of just started to push them away, you know, just kind of push my stepmother away, push my father away, just kind of keep them at bay and keep them over there. And it was working just fine for me. Yeah, it was working just fine. But anyway, so fast forward, I'm nursing this kind of pushing them away and pushing them out of my lives for over the course of 2 years. And then in October of 2017, I find out I have this little health problem. And I tell my stepmother, and we start to talk or whatever. And as it all goes along the way, it turns out that I have to have a surgery. And I'm talking to her on the phone, and I tell her I have to have a surgery. And she said, I'll be there. She didn't say, do you want me to come? She didn't say, do you need any help? She didn't say anything other than, I'll be there. And I said, okay. And so I have the surgery the day after Christmas, and she's there. She and my dad are there, and then my dad leaves, and she comes home with me to take care of me. And she's loving, and she's kind. And then she left shortly thereafter. She didn't overstay her welcome. And I will tell you that that's another instance where God gave me a gift that was wrapped in a very ugly package. Because for me, having a health problem was scary. It was something that I hadn't dealt with. Didn't know what was wrong, and then had to go through a surgery. I've never had to do any of this. This was all weird and scary. But I will tell you, after it was all said and done, what I got out of that was the ability to let go of all that and a repaired relationship with my stepmother. This woman has been married to my father for over 30 years, okay? And she has been a wonderful influence in my life. And I didn't want a damaged relationship with her. And it all came about because I had to have a surgery, and she came to take care of me. And I was able to let all that go and have a repaired relationship with her. And what I will tell you today is I would have 100 surgeries and go through that 100 times if I had to for a benefit like that. You know, I don't always understand why things happen in God's world like they do. But I find if I always look back, there's just something there for me. Now, that surgery actually had a ton of benefits. That's just the biggest one that happened. But in 2016, I got this new sponsor, right? And I did this thing when I got this new sponsor, and I told her, I said, you know, I would like to work on relationships, okay? I don't know if you've ever made that statement out loud, but what I would like to tell you just from experience is you probably shouldn't. It's sort of like, you know how they say don't pray for patience, right? You know why you don't pray for patience? Because then you're going to get every opportunity in the world. So that's how it worked for me. I have this new sponsor, and I say I want to work on relationships. So my idea of working on relationships was, you know, it wasn't that bad. I'm thinking just some light fine-tuning, right? I'm thinking some just light sanding off the rough edges. That's all I wanted. I just wanted a little refinement in some relationships. And bad idea. So Over the course of the next, year and a half of working with her, we start reading some things and talking about relationships. And over the course of it, there's a man that came in, because there's always a man that comes in there somewhere, right? And there's a man came in that gave me an opportunity to work on relationships, come and go. Service sponsees, everything, all these different relationship opportunities happening for me. My mother decides, who lives in the Houston area, decided she wants to sell her house and move to Michigan to be closer to my brother. Great. She sells her house, and then she breaks her ribs. And after she breaks her ribs, she has nowhere to live because she sold her house, and she needs to have surgery for her ribs. And so the good daughter says, of course you can come stay with me, Mother. That would be great. So I love my mother, okay? I love my mother. Don't misunderstand. I love my mother, okay? My mother living with me? Yeah. So that was a rough 3 months. It was only 3 months. I get it, okay? I know you don't really feel sorry for me. It was only 3 months. But it was a very long 3 months. And if you want to use the word opportunity, this would be the right time. Opportunity to practice these principles in all my affairs with my mom living in my house for 3 months. But we made it. She moved to Michigan, and she's successfully living in Michigan. I'm going to see her in a couple weeks and see my new niece that was born 9 months ago. So that'll be a fun time. But anyway, just a little piece of experience for you, just in case you were thinking about asking your sponsor to work on relationships. Highly recommend against it. Highly. So I'm going to share a couple more stories with you, then I'm going to sit down. So in December of 2014, I got a phone call from a young man. And this young man called me, and he asked me if I would come speak at their young people's convention in the state of Louisiana. And I looked at my calendar, and I had another commitment on that day, another local commitment on that day. And I told that young man, I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to attend your event, but thank you for asking me. And he said, sure, no problem. So I hung up the phone and looked at my calendar again. And that young man, in December 2014, had invited me to come speak at the Young People's Conference in Shreveport, Louisiana. And the day he asked me to speak was June 6th of 2015. So, June 6th of 2015 was the 20-year anniversary of the car accident, of that woman's death. And it occurred to me that the chances of someone calling me and asking me to share my story on the exact day, 20 years later, of that car accident, in most normal worlds, would be slim to none, right? So they were having a 3-day conference. It was June 5th, June 6th, and June 7th. They didn't invite me to speak on June 5th. They didn't invite me to speak on June 7th. They invited me to speak on June 6th of 2015, which was the 20-year anniversary of that woman's death. And I just could not shake the feeling. Just could not shake the feeling, no matter how hard I tried, that I needed to figure out how to be there. Because that's where I needed to be to honor that woman and everything that had happened. And so I called that young man back and I said, I'm sorry, I really think I made a mistake. I think I made a mistake. Is the offer still there? And he said, absolutely, we would love to have you. And so on June 6th of 2015, I was in Shreveport, Louisiana, in a conference of young people in the state of Louisiana, and I got to honor that woman by sharing her story and her family's story of forgiveness. I got to honor her and honor that through my sobriety and through being able to do something like this. And I will tell you, there is no doubt in my mind that there was nowhere I was supposed to be on June 6, 2015, except in Shreveport, Louisiana, getting to tell that woman's story and her family's story of forgiveness. I'm sure of that. After that event, this young man came up to me and he said, I know this girl in Houston who shares your story. Do you mind if I give her your phone number? And I said, I don't mind if you give her my phone number. And this young woman's name is Morgan. And I go back to Houston and Morgan called me. And she said, I got your number from Chance. And I said, great. I said, I would love to meet you. So I went and I picked her up and we went and had dinner. And she shared a little bit of her story with me and I shared a little bit of my story with her. And we had that moment of one alcoholic talking to another when we could relate to one another's story like not everybody can. And she needed that and I needed that. That young lady was awaiting her sentencing for her crime. She had already been convicted and she was awaiting her sentencing. And over the course of the next 6 to 9 months, we just kept in touch periodically. And I supported her while she went through her trial for the sentencing. And she was sentenced to 6 years of TDC time. And she went to TDC. When she went to TDC, I started to write letters to her. And we would write letters back and forth. And it came up finally that I would love to come visit you. And so we arranged it and so that I could get on her visitation list without harming my volunteer status with the state of Texas Department of Corrections. And so we arranged this stockade on her visitation list. And so in August of this year, I went to visit Morgan in prison, and we had a 2-year face-to-face visit and got to share everything in person. So it was an interesting experience for me, because when I went up to the prison to check in, I've been an inmate in a state of Texas facility, and I have been a volunteer to take AA meetings into Texas prisons, to Texas facilities. But this was my first time ever being a visitor to somebody in a state of Texas facility. And so I drive up in I have this cute little sports car, and I drive up in my sports car, and all the guards are like, "Hey, that's a nice car," and they're all being nice to me, right? And they're all being like, "Hey," and I'm like, "Hey," and so they search my car, you know, we do the whole search thing and everything, and I'm like, "Well, that's weird," and then I get in, and everybody's just being so nice, and I walk in, the guards are nice, and the chaplain's there, and he's like, "Who are you here to see?" And he sits at my table and is just talking to me while I'm waiting for Morgan to come in, and Morgan comes in, we have our visit, and I left, and it was kind of surreal for me. It was a new surreal experience, and the reason is because I had this thought that these guards don't know who I am, you know? Like, they don't know that I'm a convicted felon. And I wonder if they knew, if I was a convicted felon, if they'd have been so nice to me, right? Let me tell you the thought that followed that up, though. The thought that followed that up was, "Tammy, that was 23 years ago. You are not that girl. You are not that girl who came in here 23 years ago and did all those things." You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life, that those guards didn't know and don't need to know, and I am not that girl anymore. You know, I am not that girl that came in here 23 years ago. So it was an interesting experience. I'm going back to see her in a couple of weeks, and so I'm going to go visit with her again. It's picture day at the prison, and so I have to bring a lot of quarters so that we can buy pictures, because it's picture day at the prison. So I'm just delighted. It's the thing of she writes me letters, and in one of the paragraphs she shared this stuff that was very important to her about how she feels about herself as a result of her actions. And she said in her letter, "You know, Tammy, I can't share that with anybody but you, because you're the only person who would understand," right? And we understand a lot of things in AA, but there are some things that just, you know, are just I need to know that somebody else understands. And the hand of God reaching out, you know, at the 20-year anniversary of that woman's car accident and at the Lacey Powell event, you know, put me in touch with this girl so we can have that relation that, you know, we just can't get everywhere. So it's been an amazing experience. So I'm gonna tell you one more story, and then I'm gonna sit down. So every year on June 6th, I know what day it is. I wake up in the morning on June 6th, and I know what day it is. It's June 6th. It's the next year since the car accident. And every year on June 6th, I wake up and I say a special prayer. You know, I say a special prayer for the welfare of those families and everybody involved, and then I go to work. You know, I go to work. I always make sure that I go to a meeting somewhere on June 6th and talk about it, about why it's a special day for me. And every year I come home on June 6th and I feel like I was supposed to do something and I didn't do it. That there was something that I was supposed to do that I missed. And I couldn't figure it out. I was like, but I said a special prayer for them, and I was a good citizen, and I went to a meeting, and I come home, and I just felt like I had missed something. There was something I was supposed to do that I didn't do. And for years and years and years and years and years, I just couldn't figure it out, but I always felt like I was missing something. This year, before June 6th came, I had an opportunity to talk to my sponsor, and I told her, I said, you know, June 6th is coming up, and, you know, here's what I plan to do. And I said, every year I feel like I'm missing something, and we had talked about this before. And I said the words to her, you know, I'm making a living amends by my actions or whatever. And she said, well, why don't we look at it like this? She said, why don't we look at it, and instead of calling it a living amends, let's not call it that. She said, an amends is an event that happens. You know, you've either made an amends or you haven't made an amends. You know, it's not, there's nothing in between. You either have done it or you haven't done it. She said, have you done it? I said, I've done it. She said, okay, you've made the amends. She said, why don't we now, instead of saying that, say, we're practicing right living. We're practicing right living. And I said, huh. That's interesting. Now, does it sound like the same thing to you? It kind of sounds like the same thing to me a little bit, right? But the reality is there was something that clicked in my mind when she said that. There was something that clicked in my mind that said, that makes sense to me. Let's practice right living. So June 6, 2018 comes along, and I wake up in the morning and I say a special prayer for them like I do every year, and I went to work because I'm a good employee, and I went to work and I did my job to the best of my ability that day. June 6, 2018 was on the first Wednesday of June this year, which is my night to take an AA meeting into prison. And so on that night, I take an AA meeting into prison, and we have a meeting with these girls, and I led the meeting, and I led the meeting on the promises. And I told them why that day was special to me. I shared with them my experience, and we had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after the meeting, a young woman came up to me and she said, I've been trying to get to this meeting and I haven't been able to make it, but I made it tonight. And she said, I'm so glad you're here. I have the same charge that you have, and I really needed to hear what you had to say. And I said, I'm so glad you're here. And I went home on June 6th of 2018, and I felt like I had finally done enough. I felt like I had finally done enough. I didn't really do anything different, but I had finally done enough. I did everything that I was supposed to do. I don't know why. I don't know why it took 23 years. I have no idea why. 23 years later, I finally left or came home on June 6th, and I said, what I did today was enough. I lived right today. I lived right and did everything that I was supposed to do. And then I had a really striking thought right after that. Not right after that, I'm sorry. Over the course of the next couple of months, I had this really striking thought because the idea of doing enough was just monumental to me. And over the course of the next couple of months, what I realized about my life was that I have enough. So it talks in the 12 and 12 in steps 4 or 5 somewhere that we're the kind of people who are grabbing for more of everything, you know, scared we're not going to have enough or scared that we're going to lose what we have or whatever. So we eat, drink, and grab for more of everything. And everything in my life pre-sobriety was always grabbing for more of everything, and there was never enough. And what I realized after that was I have enough of everything. I have enough of everything. Now, don't misunderstand. If my job comes to me and says, we would like to promote you and give you a raise, I'm not going to turn them down, okay? I'm not going to turn them down. If I get introduced to a new friend and I get more love in my life, I'm not going to turn that down, right? I am not going to turn down any of those things. But I have enough. I have enough of everything that I need and enough of everything that I want. What an incredible gift. What an incredible, incredible gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me to feel like I have enough. You know, it's incredible. I'm going to close real quick. So in the doctor's opinion, the last paragraph says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no God of my understanding. No God of my understanding, and I didn't want one. Thank you very much. When I was at that safety, they made us go to meetings. And when we went to those meetings, at the end, we would hold hands and we would say the Lord's Prayer. And I would say, I'm not going to say the Lord's Prayer, and you can't make me. You know, I will hold hands because I'll get in trouble if I don't. But you could not make me say the Lord's Prayer. I didn't want anything to do with God. I didn't want anything to do with prayer. I didn't want anything to do with any of it. And over the course of the last 22 years of me being sober, you guys have opened up my world to a God of my understanding. I have become willing to take the action to stay sober and to live this way of life. And over the course of those years, you have introduced me and given me the latitude to find a God of my understanding. And today, at the end of the meeting, we're going to hold hands and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer. And you know what? I'm going to say it with you. And you know why I'm going to say it with you? It's not because the Lord's Prayer has some deep spiritual meaning for me. It's not. I've known the words to the Lord's Prayer ever since I was a child, you know, and that's not it. The reason I do it is because I hold hands with you and I say the Lord's Prayer because I want what you have. And I don't want to be different. I don't want to be different. I want to be one among many. And the way that I do that is to do what you do. And so I came here a scoffer, and I'm going to stay and I'm going to pray with you. And I thank y'all so much for having me here tonight.